This is Glow in the Dark Radio. The science fiction podcast with original independent science fiction written and performed by Mike Luoma, with music by Kevin MacLeod. The Vatican Assassin Trilogy and The Adventures of Alibi Jones by Mike Luoma are available in ebook, trade paperback, and audiobook wherever you find your books online. Get links and details at glowinthedarkradio.com. This is the science fiction podcast, Glow in the Dark Radio. I'm your host, your writer and reader, Mike Luoma. And we are getting into something new this week, the Archmage's History of the Future. Now, this is the backstory for the Vatican Assassin Trilogy and the Adventures of Alibi Jones. It's basically the past in my fictional universe, today up through the future. The earliest times known to the 2040s, in this first installment. The Archmage is a character Alibi Jones encounters beneath a Vermont mountain in the starseeds of Earth. We don't know exactly who he is yet. Well, I do, but you know what I'm saying. But he does seem to know a great deal and seems to have been a good, maybe, member of the race now known as the Ancient Enemy. Now, I actually begin this in character as the Archmage, in his voice, but then I kind of shift into the narrator mode once the actual history kind of gets going. Now, this is, in part, some of the same material I brought to you about 30 episodes back, but I wanted to re-podcast it so you could get it in, so you could hear it, before the unheard-of installments come up next, because those are on the way. And those you haven't heard, you've just heard a little bit of the beginning here. And in a couple of weeks, I'll be letting you know how you can get this as an ebook or paperback. Now, patrons got special editions of these, so I need to create some mass market commercial versions, basically. And once I do, I will let you know how you can get your hands on those. Speaking of ebooks, commercial and otherwise, head to Smashwords. You can get the Starseeds of Earth ebook for free this month. It's the Smashwords Summer Winter Sale, so if you go to smashwords.com, you can get the Starseeds of Earth for free as part of that sale. Smashwords does a big sale twice a year. The Smashwords Summer Winter Sale, of course, it's summer here, but winter in the Southern Hemisphere. So it's your chance this July to get a lot of different books for very low prices. And, of course, the Starseeds of Earth. For free, just go to smashwords.com, look for Starseeds of Earth or Mike Luoma, M-I-K-E-L-U-O-M-A, and you'll be able to get in on that. I want to thank the folks from Flash Pope for plugging my show, talking about Glow in the Dark Radio. And in turn, I want to remind you to check out Flash Pope. And coming up next, we will get into part one of the Archmage's History of the Future on Glow in the Dark Radio.
The Flesh Pulp Podcast. 3 to 10 minutes of fiction brought to you thrice weekly. 200 miles below the surface of the Earth, at the terminus of a series of long-sealed caverns and interconnected shines, under the shadow of the eternally bleeding eye, there is a crippled wreck of a man writing tales, stories of a dimension engulfed in madness. He is writing them of you. Think them all at fleshpulp.com or search for it on iTunes.
The Archmage's History of the Future by Mike Luong. In the beginning, I, the Archmage, can tell of the long time, having seen the cycles, having lived as both a human and one of the people. For in the time before your time now, the people ruled the settled planets of the universe with a firm yet fair grip. Yet all who rule seem destined to corruption and collapse when in power too long. Whether it was power itself or the entrenchment of power which corrupts, I cannot say. Still, it does corrupt in time. The best of the people fretted, while the worst ascended. The people became known for cruelty. Our rule became an iron fist, crushing the freedoms of so many races under our dominion. Power which was given can be taken away as well. When those we ruled grew weary of our reign, they conspired to throw off our yoke. And the few best of us left helped them. We turned the race we had created eons ago to take care of our needs, the servants, against us. Altered their bioenergetics so they could betray their masters and become the Eldred. When we were enlisted in the longevity plans of Azamet and the elite of the people, for they needed expertise only some of the best could offer, and we conspired to alter those plans. Our energies would join with those of the elite traveling through time to find and reap our future sown. We would seek the harvest of our race's last desperate attempt to survive. The starseeds, the manifest urge of the people to live, even as our homeworld was destroyed. For the Eldred proved most capable creations. They allied the other races against us, overthrew us, and destroyed our planet, our homeworld. They would go on to rule, in turn, for a million years, until they too grew corrupt and cruel. And blind there, own limitations, as the people had. As the Eldred ascended and the people fell, the star seeds carried our urge to live out into the universe and on into the future. More than a million were launched. The star seeds sped through the night, fiery balls of water, proteins, amino acids, and potential. Gravity formed new worlds orbiting infant stars, pulled together matter and surrounding energy, and protoplanets coalesced. Starseeds pounded protoworlds, creating pools of potential life, soupy steaming cauldrons of essential amino acids and basic compounds. Strands sent forth by the urge started a million worlds down the course towards life. The way of evolution, the path to self-realization, intelligence, and motivation. In the right places, under the right circumstances, it began again. Sentience, the drive to survive, to live, to become, to explore, to span space, to live among the stars. And all the while, the star seeds continued their sowing. So it continued through a million years. Worlds rise and fall, each isolate alone, yet the urge incarnates each time, when it can. For the Eldred also seek the star seeds, to destroy them before they can evolve. The Eldred discovered the longevity plan, when we, the best of us, told them of it. Still, some new races got through. Each time the urge advanced, seeds were sown, races rose, took flight, spanned space, and expanded into the stars. Eventually, Homo sapiens arrive, a human incarnation of the urge, on planet Earth, on the fringe of the star seeds' dispersal. Earth was on the fringe, but this arm of the galaxy was an active place and a target for starseeds. There were many races out there ahead of humankind, principalities and powers vying amongst themselves for position. Long before humans ever thought coherent thoughts, For many millennia, humankind believed it was alone. Yet you were not alone. Those who came before were not above interference. At least two races knew of Earth and visited and interfered over time. The Flays and the Domo attempted stealth, but their meddling created legends and mythologies, from UFO greys back to shape-shifting vampires. And we, the best of us, we arrived accidentally well before them, and yet discovered we'd found our way just the same. Traveling through time and space with the bioelectrical matrices of the elite of the people, we detached from the mob upon perceiving a planet with potential life receptacles, and came down to your Earth, deciding to teach and live among you, our chosen human names occasionally echoing down through your myths and histories. Which brings us up to your time. Most of us were long gone, or sleeping the sleep of long stasis, by the time humankind seemed to leap for space, then settle back down through your 1960s and 70s. From my own stony sleep, I saw the shortages force humankind back into space and watched humankind return to the moon for raw materials, build 3 commercial space stations in orbit and 6 commercial outposts on the moon to pump out raw materials. The US, Japanese, and EU together established a lunar base and colony, central hub for a growing number of lunar habitations and industrial operations. Moon mined mineral wealth was also fused and shaped into more orbital platforms, workstations, and colonies, where more raw materials were processed, then sent down to Earth. The commercialization of space took off. The moon shipped raw materials to orbital assembly stations, which created goods for an ever-growing Earth populace, dropping them down the gravity well to hungry hordes. The ships carried goods down, supplies came back up, supply runs paid for by the goods sold. The technology wasn't yet truly ready to support large-scale populations on the moon. Orbital colonies weren't perfected yet either. They tended to be dangerous, prone to air leaks, oxygen shortages, and waste recycling nightmares. But these problems didn't slow the race to space. The commercial potential of space was tapped, and corporations wanted more. Government and commercial partnerships began exploring ways to push further out, to get to Mars and the mineral wealth of the asteroids. Soon, humankind didn't have any choice but to expand into space. Overpopulation led to demand outstripping supply. Population pressures taxed the delivery system. Goods stopped reaching consumers, and there were riots and rationing. Wealthy individuals built orbital retreats to get away from the population on Earth. Overpopulation became a marketing tool for selling paranoid rich people orbital getaways in space, as at first only the very wealthy could afford to build, staff, and maintain these luxury stations. Most rotated to give a semblance of gravity, using interconnected systems requiring small, versatile crews to run and maintain. The necessities of life had to be provided for the crew and inhabitants. All those people had to eat, breathe, and live on the station, or be shipped back and forth to a nearby commercial platform or station. It was an expensive proposition, especially in the early days, but over time, costs came down, and orbital platforms became attainable for second echelon wealth. As population pressure increased, Earth's governments started looking into orbital or lunar colonies as possible population relief valves. Their initial lunar colonizing effort, however, was a thinly disguised recruitment campaign for workers for the companies mining the surface of the moon. The lunar population of company workers were ostensibly under UN jurisdiction, but it was really the megacorporations who called the shots, until IMC mercilessly and publicly gunned down a rogue worker, inviting public outcry. No individual Earth government alone was powerful enough to sanction IMC, so they worked together through the UN, strengthening the muscle of the world body to give their sanctions some bite, committing more funds and troops. The Secretary General used this opportunity to extend the UN's powers, securing independent control of the moon under joint UN security forces, placing all orbital facilities under enforceable UN jurisdiction. The Earth's governments then stepped up their efforts towards Mars and the asteroids, pressured by the IMC and other megacorps to find new sources of raw materials. The drive for Mars gave the governments reason to build their own new facilities on the moon, a lunar staging area, a base for the mission that grew to serve as the new central port for the moon. The 2030s. Reagan Station was officially dedicated on the moon in 2030 by the cooperating governments of Earth, signaling a fresh start. Primarily a research station for the Mars mission, it paid for itself through commercial enterprise. The US, the EU, and Russian governments partnered with an entertainment group in a first-of-its-kind pairing of utility and frivolity. The entertainment group paid a fee and taxes to the governments. In exchange, they got space on the station and supply space on shuttles up from Earth, and the chance to make a profit from all the workers on the moon. An entire entertainment complex was built into the station, with movie theaters, restaurants, bordellos, churches, temples, and other diversions. For the first time, aside from onboard the luxury stations of the very wealthy, more than just the bare essential needs of the population in space were considered. It was an original approach that drew both praise and scorn. Some religious groups expressed outrage over the contents of some of the entertainment. Some politicians argued it was a waste of precious air and space. Ultimately, economic realities pushed the partnership ahead, and the moon entered a new phase of colonization with more focus on both science and entertainment. The entertainment group then acquired space in orbit, and the first station solely devoted to worker entertainment opened soon after in an abandoned luxury station. This new opportunity didn't go unnoticed. The group's major competitor sued, citing restraint of trade, saying they were unfairly shut out of this new opportunity, and the governments were forced to find space for them on the moon and in orbit. These were distractions for the governments, focused on launching a Mars mission from Reagan Station before the end of the year. The first manned Mars mission left Reagan Station in 2030, on the last day of 2030, but still in 2030. The trip to Mars took a year and a half. There was gravity on a portion of the ship, so the crew could exercise and stay fit. Their mission was to establish a working base on Mars and live there for a year and a half, setting up hydroponic gardens, installing life systems, and general housekeeping so the base could be sustained. Another mission would follow after a year and a half. At that time, they'd go back to Earth. Governments involved wanted to quickly establish a constantly manned base on Mars. The next mission left on schedule in 2032, as news of the first ship's arrival on Mars reached Earth and the Moon. The first mission successfully deployed on the surface of Mars as the new ship powered up for its own long journey. By the time the new ship arrived at the end of 2033, there were casualties. A husband and wife, xeno-archaeologists, disappeared while on a long-distance reconnoiter. Other news was not immediately released to the general public. The two xeno-archaeologists had uncovered alien artifacts, evidence of another civilization, not necessarily Martian in origin. The ruins were just the smallest remains of an alien staging area on Mars, a base possibly used when interfering with Earth. This wasn't revealed to the public until 2039. The U.S. kept the information under wraps. It was alleged, but never proven, that the U.S. had discovered similar artifacts on the moon years earlier. The bodies of husband and wife were never recovered. The nature of their disappearance was not fully explained when the rest of the expedition returned in 2035, just chalked up to the inhospitability of the Red Planet. But in official circles, it was suggested that they had been abducted, perhaps by the very aliens whose artifacts they had been rummaging around in, although the ruins had seemed rather old and useless. No other alien ruins or artifacts were discovered by the successive Mars missions of 2033 or 2035. The Mars base tried to become self-sustaining, but was left unmanned at the end of 2035. A number of factors made it hard to continue. The distance to home became hard to deal with after a year and a half. Many Mars colonists spent their return trips under some kind of sedation. It wasn't the distance that was the problem, the governments figured, but rather the inability to cross that distance quickly. The UN's power eroded as the megacorps extended their new Earth-based freedoms to Earth orbit and the Moon. Class increasingly divided the human population. Wealthy megacorporate elite, mid-level consumers, and service workers. The UN was dealt a severe blow when Muslim nations Egypt and Syria withdrew from the space programs and then from the world body in 2035, in protest of what they called its Judeo-Christian bias. They condemned the West as infidels and fought against this perceived bias. Their claim of Judeo-Christian bias was reinforced when the alien artifact information came out in 2039. In 2036, the UTZ, United Trade Zone, was established, uniting the U.S., Canada, Mexico, South and Central America, and the EU and Russia in a free trade zone, also encompassing those countries' holdings on the Moon, in orbit, and even Mars. The UTZ Governing Council was made up of CEOs and politicians from each of the countries, wolves watching the henhouse. The mega corporations had free run, although the U.S. and other Earth governments tried to hold on to control of the Moon and the Mars projects. The governments decided to try to mount a return mission to the base on Mars to reinvigorate Mars and their Moon station. Back on Earth, Asia became a source of conflict. The Chinese Revolution of 2037 was a long time coming, and as much about access to goods and services as it was about casting off a century of communist rule. The Chinese people wanted all the stuff they saw the workers of the non-communist world consuming. Technology outstripped the communist government's ability to censor the people's information, and that information made the people want to buy, buy, buy. When the new democratic Chinese government was installed, it was barely a government at all. A large single-body parliament with a prime minister and a president elected by the people, but they had no true power. The megacorporations had moved in immediately after the new government joined the UTZ. English became a predominant language in the new China and the world in general, to the alarm of many cultural purists. Cultures blended furiously as the UTZ knocked down old barriers in the name of trade. Japanese cultural purists then sounded the alarm, fearing Asia would be westernized. The proud Japanese tradition bred extremists unwilling to compromise, to join in the westernization of the culture. But the Chinese, cowed for a century by the communists, bowed readily to their new commercial masters. The Japanese had formed their own trade zone, the Pacific Trade Cooperative, or PTC, in 2035, but it had floundered. There were only a couple of Japanese stations in orbit, and they had no holdings on the Moon. At this time, Japan was also torn by ultra-nationalist fervor. The PTC struggled in the face of Japan's own isolationism. It eventually allied itself with the UTZ as an agent of the UTZ by 2039. The PTC became a puppet organization, but still retained enough control to remain external to the main group. The UN was dealt another blow in 2037, when the African National Council withdrew. Many countries grumbled about the UN's inability to get anything done. Tensions in the always volatile Middle East flared up again as Muslim hardliners gained political control along with religious power. More and more subjugated workers turned away from the megacorps and towards Islam and Allah. 2039 saw a new joint mission to Mars, an attempt to try again. Organized by the U.S., the UN had a member on board, and the UTZ as well. IMC was a major sponsor and had 10 of their scientists on the crew. Dubbed Operation Trailblazer, the mission was an ambitious attempt to indeed blaze a trail for future travelers. IMC had developed new technology, promising ultrasonic travel using a series of magnetic loops. The reaction of magnetic forces propelled magnetized bullet-like ships through these magnetic loops onward, faster and faster, loop by loop. Operation Trailblazer was a construction project, setting up these loops in space as it cruised on toward Mars. The idea behind the loops, a ship could leave the moon, propel itself through the first loop, and the magnetic force would amplify the speed of the ship. The ship then reached the second loop and came out even faster, then hit the third, the fourth, and so on, until at midpoint, the ship reversed polarity and began to slow down as it went through each successive loop. The loops were massive, like giant round suspension bridges to nowhere floating in space. They were assembled just off the moon by IMC. Trailblazer's job was to push them out to where they belonged and turn them on. Trailblazer made Mars in early 2040, followed in a month by the first ship down the magnetic loop, Highway, a supply ship. There were problems. Acceleration was hard to cushion against and compensate for, and the human body didn't take kindly to too many G-forces. The force of the speed their ship attained killed the first bullet ship's crew. IMC made adjustments. Softer acceleration. Better shock absorption. Soon bullet ships were buzzing up and down the Magloop Highway, as it came to be called, carrying people and supplies back and forth to Mars. IMC and other megacorporations began mining Mars for raw materials, shipping people in on bullet ships, sending raw materials back. The Magloop Highway allowed for the rapid colonization of Mars as megacorporations raced to exploit its resources and designated supply areas ceded to them by the governments involved in earlier exploration. The Japanese, through their agency involvement in the UTZ-PTC Pact, began joining in the exploration of Mars in a major way. As humans began trying to tame the planet of the God of War, wars for God broke out on their home planet. Israel invoked an old clause from the peace accords that allowed them to again take back sole control of Jerusalem if duly threatened. They did this and asked for help not from the UN, but from the UTZ, to help keep out those they expelled and maintain the security of Israel and Jerusalem. Extremist Muslim governments allied with Iran now ruled Egypt and Syria. The only reason they didn't yet rule the Palestinian state was they could not. It was not allowed under the accords. But after their expulsion from Jerusalem, extremists overpowered more moderate Palestinian leaders. The 30s ended with the earth a pressure cooker waiting to blow. That was part one of the Archmage's History of the Future on Glow in the Dark Radio through the 2040s. And we will pick things up in the 2050s next week as we continue to hear how we got from our present day to the future that all the stories take place in, beginning with the Vatican Assassin Trilogy. And I'll be giving you the chance to get your hands on this future history as an ebook or a paperback. You can already do that if you're a patron. Just find the post where I give you the links and the passwords and you got it. So again, if you want to become a patron, you can just go to patreon.com/glowinthedarkradio or go to glowinthedarkradio.com and look for the Patreon link right there. And that'll take you there. $2, $5, and $10 a month is what I have for tiers, the different levels you can become a member of Glow in the Dark Radio on Patreon for. They take care of dinging your card and putting it together so I get it each month. You know, the taxes and all that, which is kind of cool. Sometimes there's things they do I don't like, but, you know, for the most part, they do okay. So Patreon.com, it allows people to support this podcast, so I gotta like that. Patreon.com/glowinthedarkradio, or just go to Glow in the Dark Radio and look for the Patreon links for that. Into the 2050s on our next episode. That is all for this week. I'm your host, your writer and reader, Mike Luoma. Thank you again for checking out Glow in the Dark Radio. Glow in the Dark Radio. This podcast presentation is copyright 2021 by Michael F. Luoma and is protected under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. CC by NCND 4.0. Music by Kevin MacLeod. You can find his work at Accompetech.com and filmmusic.io. Mike's books are available in ebook, paperback, and audiobook wherever you find books online. Get links and more details at glowinthedarkradio.com and mikeluoma.com. This has been a presentation of Glow in the Dark Radio.